Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour, your weekly podcast covering retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And I'm Ravi Abbott.
Now, this week on the show, like every week, we bring you a very interesting guest, and this week, the dark side of computing.
Yes, we have Galahad from Fairlight. Now, you may know about the Ware scene and the cracking scene. Fairlight were probably the biggest crime syndicate cracking group in the world. So we're going to say a disclaimer here at the Retro Hour, which is we don't condone piracy. You know, people work hard for these games, but with every format, piracy has existed. So from the days of the printing press to the floppy disk, they've had it. And we think this history must not be forgotten. You know, this reproduction has led to innovation and creation. So we're going to explore it. We don't condone it, but we're going to talk about it because we don't want to forget.
That's a disclaimer out the way.
Yep.
Now, Galahad, though, is part of, anyone that did kind of copying in the playground back in the old days, you'll have seen the Fairlight logo flashing up before a lot of old Amiga games and LSD he was part of, Grapevine Dismag, I used to love reading that.
Yeah, even the top torrent sites now still have Fairlight releases on them.
Well, I think it's, like you said, it's important to remember this because we've had the developers on, we've had the guys behind the games, but it's important to kind of get the other side of that as well, I think. So,
yeah.
Galahad is going to be on the show in around 40 minutes from now. And you can get the podcast in even more places now then, Ravi.
Oh, yes. So now we're on Stitcher. Now, if you don't know about Stitcher, this is supposed to be the second biggest format to iTunes, which BBC Radio 4 even did a massive feature on how we should all use Stitcher.
Pretty slick, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty nice. So we're on Stitcher and TuneIn as well.
And you can get the show every Friday, also on iTunes, where we are still new and noteworthy, I've seen this week. So
yes, still rocking it.
Thank you to the guys at iTunes. If you do listen on there, please do leave a review. That always helps. And that you can download the show every Friday from our website direct at theretrohour.com. Right, a few stories to get into this week then. This is quite interesting. Radio 1 Fight Games King of the Thrill. What's this about then, Ravi?
Okay, I don't know if you've seen this on iPlayer. Radio 1 are basically doing their gaming show, monthly gaming show now.
We mentioned this, didn't we,
yes,
a few months ago?
Now they've started doing iPlayer kind of 20-minute episodes talking about gaming. Now, this one was the Thrill of the Kill, which was the history of gaming. It was aimed at a younger audience like, Radio 1 is, but it was all based on Street Fighter. Literally, it could have been an advert for Street Fighter. It was like there was mentions of Mortal Kombat and other stuff, but still good to see mainstream media kind of having a look at this. So that's Fight Games, the King of the Thrill. Check that on the BBC iPlayer at the moment. I think it'll be up for a couple of weeks.
Is it video or audio this
is? It's video, this one is. Yeah, and they interview all the kind of Radio 1 presenters. And most of them go, oh, I love Street Fighter, it's wicked, douse him.
It's a good timing because Street Fighter 5's just come out, hasn't it?
Yeah, then they go up to Street Fighter 5, but they also go to like a retro pub and talk to a guy who's got all these kind of old ones and kind of talks briefly about the history of fighting games.
You know what? I was reading about Street Fighter V. I haven't played it yet, actually. It was going to be on my to-buy list, but I've heard apparently there's no single player in it.
Oh, my God.
There's no arcade mode.
What, it's just battling?
Yeah, apparently. Game. You know, like on the old Street Fighter, if your mates weren't around, you could play it on your own. You'd just give you, like, a list of the enemies. Apparently that mode isn't in it anymore.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah, because they're saying, with gaming the way it is now, people don't sit together and fight anymore, and they're kind of exploring that. There's a whole little section on the psychology of fighting games as well, so it's quite interesting.
So we'll leave a link to that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Worth a watch if you're in the UK.
Yep.
Now, some Nintendo news.
I don't know if you've seen this, Dan. This is all over the internet, and you guys have probably seen this already, which is that 3D NES emulator that brings 2D classics into real life, into 3D spaces. Have you seen it?
Right, I'm looking here then. There's a little a demo of Mario. So, yeah, it basically looks a bit like it could be like an early 3D game. They've kind of just angled stuff down and give it kind of a 3D perspective.
Yeah, so I guess it's an algorithm or something that, converts every block into a kind of 3D one. And they're saying it's working good on some games, like Castlevania is supposed to be really good, and then other games it's not working so well. So
I think there must be some kind of automated process. It must be painstaking to go through frame by frame and every object and every block in here as well.
Yeah, I think, it kind of redraws it. And it's quite interesting, though, displaying these old games in a new way.
I think Nintendo, they've just got this thing about 3D. Even go back to the Virtual Boy, then obviously the 3DS. They just want to get 3D out there, I think, don't they?
Yeah.
But I was thinking when I saw this, I thought it would be kind of cool to have this on the 3DS, like a proper old-school 3D Mario game that was in true 3D.
Yeah, that's what they're saying, a 3D NES. Mm-hmm. has 3D support. I don't know if you'd be able to get it on the 3DS.
So I'll pop a link to that if you want to check it out. Now, one of my favourite games on the C64, a friend of mine used to have, Pang.
Was always fun. It like an arcade classic, wasn't it?
Yeah, Japanese game, I think, wasn't it? And they're bringing this back then.
Yeah, I've seen that they've made a remake. Maybe as a Pang fan, you can explain more to us.
Well, it was a big 8-bit game, and it came out on the Amiga and the ST and stuff like that as well. And by the looks of this, they've given it a reboot. And there's a little trailer here of it running on the PS4. And I've got to say, you know, it is, a lot of games get like a reboot and they kind of go a little bit over the top and ruin them. But I've got to say, the graphics on this, they look improved, but I don't think they go like all out and kind of spoil the original essence of the game by the looks of it.
Yeah, it looks like they haven't gone for hyper-realistic, but they've gone more cartoony. Nice, defined cartoon.
There's not explosions everywhere and flashing neon and like there is in so
many
of these
remakes. Even though it does say there's all new power-ups, including flamethrowers and lasers.
So, there's only the trailer available at the moment, but it's going to be out April 19th, available on PS4, Xbox One, PC and mobile as well.
Pang, I'll have to give it a go. One I've missed.
Yeah, it was a good game back in the day, Pang. Now, something else that's coming back as well. Everything's getting a reboot at the moment. Did you ever play Day of the Tentacle?
Oh, my God. This is when I left Amiga and got into the PC, when Full Throttle was coming out, Day of the Tentacle, all of these great point and clicks with full voice and motion, you know, they were just amazing. And Day of the Tentacle is well funny. If you've ever played it, it's one of the funniest games. You know, your LucasArts classic, and it's through good old games. So you can pre-order it.
Because sometimes these reboots are a bit hit and miss. I remember, do you remember Loom?
No, I don't actually remember Loom. I remember The Dig, that was a point of
clear. No, that was way later. Loom, okay. I think, was one of their first ones. That was 1990 it came out. And if you go on Monkey Island, when you go in the scum bar, there's a pirate there who goes, ask me about Loom, and then he gives you like an advert for it.
He's advertising the
that was one of the funniest scenes in Monkey Island. But all the way through the Monkey Island franchise, even up to like Curse... Yeah, in 97, and like the Tales ones that came out about 5-6 years ago, they've kind of got a running joke that they'll always mention Loom at some point in a Monkey Island game. So that's kind of threaded through the entire series. But they did reboot Loom on the PC in around probably about 94, 95.
Yeah.
And they made it a CD-ROM title. But it was kind of the early days of CD where, you know, they only had the 600 megabyte storage and they had to chop a lot of the game out. A lot of the dialogue to get the talking in there and upgrade the graphics to 256 colours. But I saw it on Steam only about a week ago and I thought, I wouldn't mind playing Loom again. So I give it a download. But unfortunately, it's that PC talkie version with like half the game missing.
Yeah, so it's not like, this one looks insane. Yeah. This is, you know, amazingly redone. And actually, it was never released on the Amiga, but I know there's an AGA version that's doing the rounds of Day of the Tentacle.
What is this, like a ScumVM thing or something, is it?
Yeah, ScumVM. I don't know. Have you ever used ScumVM, Dan?
Yeah, ScumVM's awesome. So if you're not familiar with that, it's an engine that's available for many platforms, and it lets you play, because all of these old LucasArts games and stuff used the same engine, didn't they, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Different variants of it. And I think that's probably where, you know, there was the Scum Bar in Monkey Island.
It stands for, it was actually based from Manic Mansion.
Right, is that what the original
was
started?
Which was the first one, yeah. So it's Script Creation Utility for Manic Mansion.
I never knew that. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, so I guess Manic Mansion must have been the first one that they created and then continued developing that engine.
Well, I imagine the engine got updated as it went throughout the years, but I think Curse of Monkey Island was the last game that used it, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was about 97, I think, that
came out. But even, you know, 89 or... 1990, they would have Leisure Suit Larry's, I think.
That's Sierra, wasn't it? It was Sierra. But but a lot of these games, and basically what you can do if you haven't tried ScumVM before, you can download it. And even if this particular game didn't exist on the platform that you're playing on, you can still play the games in this kind of wrapper.
Yes, yeah. Well, they're also saying, actually, here it's all compatible with Sierra stuff as well.
Okay.
So you've got everything, Space Quest, King's Quest, you know, Leisure Suit Larry... all of the games, Simon the Sorcerer.
No, that was a great game, yeah.
Everything was based on this engine. And, yeah, you can use it on any format as well. So, you know, you can get ScumVM Player on your tablet.
Yeah. It's basically like MAME for, like, point-and-click adventures, isn't it, really?
Yeah, totally. Like, there hasn't been many point-and-clicks around recently, have there?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of these, because we mentioned a couple of weeks ago about the Monkey Island reboot, you know, I've got it on my iPad with the full talking and, like I said, Loom and that. I think a lot of them, but... they tend to be remakes of the old ones.
It was a very kind of personal adventure, wasn't it? When you were sitting at home, pointing and clicking and exploring a world by yourself, it's very kind of personal. And now, multiplayer, I guess you can do that with
a group. Well, there's still good adventure games out there. but I think it's more stuff like The Walking Dead and Life is Strange and stuff, which the more like just cinematic movies that you kind of take part in and shape the story, but you haven't quite got the exploration that you got with Point and Click.
Or the comedy.
Comedy's missing from games these days a lot, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. They're all too serious. You want to have something stupid.
But I remember, just playing Monkey Island 1 and 2 and stuff, and like there'd be certain things you'd do that were just ridiculous, and they'd have you in stitches.
What was that bit where you'd... All I can remember from Monkey Island, that I played quite a bit of it, was falling off the side of a thing and then bouncing back up off a rubber tree.
Yeah, think you're dead, don't you?
Yeah.
It pops this like requester up over the screen, goes, for the first time in this game, you've died, or something like that. Yeah. And you think, oh, what? I didn't know you could die. Then, like, yeah, he bounces off a branch of a rubber tree, just appears again, and goes, phew.
It's great.
But it was hilarious.
And also Simon the Sorcerer, the woodworm.
Yeah, yeah.
Shouting at you, calling you racist and stuff. It was great.
I remember one scene in Monkey Island. It was the end when you got the cannibals locked you up.
Yeah.
And you found your way out of the little hut, and then you go back, and every time they put like a bigger lock on. Until the end, it was like the multi-save 5000 or from like 200 years in the future. So, I think, point-and-click games, it's kind of quite innocent looking back to a game where there was not really much audio. I mean, on the Scum Engine, you had kind of like, it was a bit like MIDI, wasn't it, where you played music and stuff. But there'd be no speech or anything at all. It was kind of like reading a book, I suppose, wasn't it? You'd come up with the voices in your head and that. And
people were just so used to that. Like, that kind of format of doing point and click. It was just always the same, wasn't it? It was like, FPSs would change around and stuff, but point and click was solidly Scum.
My brother and I would sit down and play these games, and I'd kind of do the voices of the characters. So he'd only be like, 5-6 years old, but we'd have a good time. It'd be like, like playing out of play, really. It was always a good laugh. So, yeah, I wouldn't mind going back and playing Loom, though, and this...
Yeah, I'll have to give that a go, actually.
Yeah, that's another game with a lot of humour in there as well. And, Day of the Tentacle, then. So this is coming out on, the time recording this next week, so March 22nd. And this is a full HD update of the original game.
Oh, wow.
And they're going to be released on the PC by the looks of it as well. So, and a PS4 game coming out a bit later on the Vita as well. So,
oh, nice. This is pretty interesting, man. This shows how much interest there still is in the Dreamcast. And it's Phantasy Star Online, which was one of the original kind of, 56K multiplayer games. It was one of the first consoles to have a modem, wasn't it?
I think it was the first one to have it off the shelf, because it was built in, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So. Well, I've actually got the broadband adapter.
Oh, those are rare.
Yeah, they are. I've looked on eBay and they're like 150 quid. I've got one. I haven't really used it all that much, though, but I was watching a couple of years ago, there's a video of a guy, he's a British guy, on YouTube, and he shows you the walkthrough of setting up Phantasy Star Online.
Yeah.
And there are still people playing this.
That's it. This is exactly what this article is saying. This guy, Soda Boy, who's a site admin, has created custom server software. So these people have signed up and they're still playing it. And he says there's 300 active players.
Really?
Still from around the world playing Phantasy Star.
I'm going to have to give it a go because there was... Do you remember when the original Xbox Live closed down?
Yeah.
That was about 2009, I think.
Yeah.
And they closed it down for the original Xbox. I remember there was, and there probably still is, a bit of software that you can download. And you basically jack your Xbox into your PC, and then it redirects Xbox Live to these private servers. And I thought, yeah, that's really cool. Tried it all that, got it all set up, and there's like one person on, So after all that, no one's even on it. But this, if there's 300 active people.
That's really crazy,
You know what I think that says, though? I think that kind of speaks volumes about the commitment to the Dreamcast and its fans, that they'll actually go to all the effort of doing it.
Yeah, and maybe that world was a fabulous world that they want to keep going back to. A lot of my friends, they play some mods. There's this mod called The Specialist for Counter-Strike. Hardly anyone plays that. I think there's 10 people in the world or 20, but they all still keep the server going. And they're still,
That reminds me of actually getting back to Xbox Live. Do you ever read the story about the final players on Halo 2?
No.
There was this group of guys, it was on a forum, and I think Microsoft closed it down. But they left the server running for a few months. Basically, if you turn your Xbox off, you couldn't reconnect to Xbox Live again. Okay. But if you were playing already, it would let you stay on. So they had this competition to be the last man standing in Halo 2. And I think the last one, I think something like his console just crashed or he had a power cut or something, but he stayed on for about 4 months or something after the servers were shut down.
Just walking around.
Yeah, on his own, yeah.
Because I think that was the original... would have to get Lord British on the show one day. That would be amazing, because he did Ultima Online. And... that was complete chaos when that ended. I think someone managed to kill Lord British or something, and then the whole place, thousands of people try to crash the server by stacking
anarchy
furniture on top of stuff. Yeah, it was chaos.
But I think people kind of do forget that the Dreamcast was one of the first online consoles as well. There was modems you could buy for the Saturn and even the Mega Drive.
Yeah.
But I think the Dreamcast has the accolade of kind of being the first system that was shipped with online out of the box.
Wasn't that one of the things that they did to try and save the Dreamcast at the end?
Was it SegaNet or something?
SegaNet, yeah, and they said, you know, you get a free Dreamcast if you sign up with this. You get all these games for free, and we'll bring more. I think it's very US-based, though. I don't think we ever got SegaNet.
I think there was something over here, but it was kind of piggybacked onto the back of another ISP. It might have been like free servers or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, the good thing about having a 56K modem, though, is you can obviously just dial direct to a number, can't you?
So, yeah, that's the one.
So yeah, if you want to play Phantasy Star Online, if you've got your Dreamcast maybe gathering dust in the cupboard.
Yeah, contact Soda Boy. We'll give you the link.
Now, this is quite a big news story in the week. I mean, it's modern gaming, but I think historically this is the first time we've seen anything like this happen.
Yeah, and it's working on the theme that we've just been discussing as well.
So the Xbox One is getting cross-platform multiplayer.
Yeah, for all different platforms as well. They're saying they want it on Windows 10, but also other platforms in the industry. So.
Which can only mean the PS4.
Yeah, well, there won't be much industry left. But
the annoying thing about consoles, I'm a console gamer, I do like playing console games, but I've got mates that have got Xboxes and I've got friends that got PlayStations, and it has been a case in the past where I've bought the same copy of a game on both platforms.
Yeah, same here, because I used to run a PC gaming community, and we'd be like, right, okay, the new GTA is coming out, everyone get it on the PC, or everyone get it on the Xbox, and you'd have to kind of go with the one that the majority of people own to get all your mates playing on it, you know.
And it's expensive.
Yeah, definitely.
Adds up. I'm not a big Call of Duty player anymore, but a few years ago when, you know, it was kind of at its peak, I'd like, my brother had, and all his friends were on Xbox, and like my mate, he's got a PlayStation 3, and like kind of those, that group of mates of mine are all more PlayStation guys.
Well, we started gifting people stuff in our community, so we were like, you know, oh, I can't afford it on the PC. It's in his Steam, you know, so that we could get enough people to join it, keep playing on that, you know.
But now, by the looks of this end, so it's a letter that that Chris Carler, the director of independent games on Xbox One and Windows 10, he's posted this letter on the Xbox website. Now, Microsoft are really trying to get Xbox and Windows 10 closer together, aren't they?
Definitely. Also because they're trailing a bit behind the PS4.
Yeah.
So they need to kind of bring Xbox. What was the Windows 10 line? 1 billion devices?
Yeah.
That was,
which is obviously a lot more than Xboxes out there.
Yeah.
I mean, PC gaming's had a big comeback recently, and I think Microsoft, being traditionally a PC company, it's logical for them to do that. And I was reading an article during the week, actually, that someone from Microsoft, one of the heads of Xbox, was saying that he wanted the next Xbox to be upgradable.
Mm.
So essentially like a PC that you put
modular.
It sounds like a PC, doesn't it?
Did you ever use games for Windows Live?
No.
GWL.
No, I never done
it. It was one of the most awful systems where they tried to integrate the Xbox before.
Yeah.
It was just awful. And
was it 360 original?
It was on a GTA 4.
Okay.
And it ruined the whole system for the PC. It was literally like you had to log into that, Games for Live, then you had to log into Rockstar Social Club, then you had to log into Steam.
Jumping through a million hoops to get there.
Yeah, totally. Just so you could get the same stats. You couldn't even play with the other guys.
Is that all it was, stats?
Yeah, yeah.
See, GTA 4 wasn't even worth the effort. I didn't like that game.
They wrecked the PC release for that.
It would be interesting. Have Sony kind of responded to this then?
I don't know, because, yeah, they must be working with Sony to work with the server technology, or are they just going to like shove a load of Xbox players suddenly into the...
Well, this article's on Wired here, and it says, we've reached out to Sony for comment, but they haven't heard back at the moment. So this is kind of, you know, this, as they describe it, a utopian world where, you know, Xbox One and PS4 players are matched hand in hand, which I think, you know, for Microsoft, that would be a good thing. I don't know whether Sony need to, though.
Yeah, no, they're probably selling enough anyways.
I thought this was quite an interesting discussion. I've been on 4chan again, Ravi.
Oh, no.
The dark side of the internet. But there is a really good, if you haven't checked out 4chan, stay away from, like, you know, /B and the politically incorrect forums and
Well, actually, 4chan's quite good now. Stay away from 8chan, guys. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's even grittier one, isn't it? But, I mean, there are some interesting subs on 4chan. In particular, there's one called /VR. They only started it last year, and it's a retro gaming.
Okay.
And it's got all the usual, you know, 4chan profanity and all that in there. But they do occasionally have some really interesting discussions. And one of them was, should you mod your retro consoles or keep them in their original state?
Interesting, very interesting, because I've got some 1200s at home, and I've got the Commodore version, the ESCOM version. ESCOM version, I don't count as original, covered in signatures, completely, you know. The Commodore
you get them signed,
kept intact.
But, I mean, you do often see guys doing stuff like RGB mods and that, don't you, to like old, you know, systems and getting them looking nice, or HDMI out, even I've seen people doing
I think there's two levels of mods. I think there's one level of mod where it's the guy who buys the PlayStation original when it comes out and then wants it to look cool, so sprays it with a crappy spray can.
That's the worst.
Those are the worst kind of mods. And then there's the guys who are later on looking at it and going, let's add some new cool stuff in. And I quite like those.
Oh, there are some awesome ones. I mean, I've seen there's an Amiga 600. I don't know if you've seen that. It's kind of an audio one. It's got like tuning knobs all the way across the top.
Oh, wow.
LCD displays in there. You'd love that. I'll find a picture of it. I'll put it in the show notes if I can find it. But it looks like, you know, it looks like it could have fallen out of some guy's like army pack or something. It's all camouflage and all that as well.
But also, there's this question with these GoTek drives.
There are some horrific mods I've
seen. There's some horrific mods because people think that they have to destroy their computer just to get USB compatibility. And it's like, man, these are old machines.
They're not going to make any more. Well, that said, they do make new cases.
So, yeah, that's the thing, as well. Like, you know, a lot of people have probably wrecked CDTV keyboards and wrecked other kind of old PlayStations and stuff, spraying them.
Yeah.
And then the molds come out. Like, you know, they're probably 3DO molds for the Chameleon, the now dead Chameleon.
So it's an interesting topic. I mean, I'm not much of a purist, but I think, like you mentioned there about the GoTek, I've seen guys who've got like Atari STs and Amigas who have literally, looks like they've just punched the side of the case in to make a big hole in it.
Yeah, or they've just gone at it with a Stanley knife, and it's not even square.
It's like, if you're going to do it, at least do it properly. Yeah. But then there are some other mods where they'll put a nice little LCD screen in there. They'll, you know, Dremel it out and it'll look really nice. And guys add stuff like, you know, HDMI outputs to the Dreamcast and stuff I've seen people doing. And I think if they look like they belong in the original product, if it fits in well with the rest of the design, then I think it's awesome.
And I don't mind a bit of a rough job, as long as it's not like flaky paint and, you know, just like an awful kind of really badly done.
I saw like there was a guy who posted in one of the Amiga groups the other day, and he's like, you know, don't flame me for this, but he showed a picture, I don't know if you saw it, of he basically chopped an Amiga 1200 in half for a keyboard. He towered it basically, but he chopped the case in half and there's all putty along the back of it to kind of stop the board falling out. And he just painted it like, you know, with like wall paint or something. It's like, looks horrendous. But he's like, I'm cringing at what 15-year-old me did. I thought he was cool back then. But
yeah, that's it. Like, I always think also you get people who have underpowered machines and try to make them look overpowered with like go faster stripes and all
LEDs
these
everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, fans of the Dizzy series, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago about a new CD32 compilation, and there is another Dizzy game that's just been released. Now, this is a fan-made title.
Oh, wicked. Wow.
This is called Adventureland Dizzy.
Adventureland?
Yeah.
I'm even seeing on this site that you've linked me, Dizzy in the Dungeons and
There's a few
Dizzy
little demo
Quest
titles here as well.
I've never seen these ones, is it?
Oh, this is jdcstudios.co.uk. And we've got to give a shout out to Neil and the team at Indie Retro News, who really good news website for retro gaming. And they've covered this, actually, this Adventureland Dizzy title is available. And apparently this is quite a big game as well. It's got 110 screens.
Wow.
Which
for
a Dizzy game.
It looks quite like Magic Land.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, looking at it graphically, it looks like maybe the graphics are taken from other Dizzy titles. It looks a bit like Treasure Island as well, some of the scenes in here. But you can download it. It's free if you want to try it.
And the
it.
One thing I love about the Dizzy games is the storylines. So if this has good storylines, I'm definitely going to play it, especially with all his family. Do you know the names of them? Like Denzel.
I wasn't a big Dizzy player,
Daisy,
I must admit.
Dizzy. It's all with D.
Okay. Okay.
Daphne. There's like, yeah, loads of them.
Yeah, so this is a fan-made game, and apparently there's been no feedback from, you know, the Oliver twins who originally made the game. So,
okay,
so at the moment, it's up and available if you want to give it a download. And it's on PC as well, so you can play it on modern platforms. So if you want to give it a download. Now, we've talked about VR quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. I think it's fair to say it's probably the biggest buzz in the gaming industry right now. But I thought this is quite interesting. On Reddit, you know DayZ, the game DayZ.
Oh, yes. I'm a big, big, big DayZ fan.
Well, Dean Hall, the guy behind that, he's been talking about...
Rocket Hall, yeah.
The full title in there. Yeah. He's kind of come out and said that he sees virtual reality as just an expensive Wii.
It's interesting because we've got a listener called Vigilante Gamer who comments a lot. And he's an old Amiga guy. He does amazing DayZ videos.
Okay.
Now, the difference with DayZ is there's no set agenda, there's no set game. You're just shoved in this sandbox world, and the situation is based on how the other person reacts or how you react to them. So it's kind of like a whole new level of interaction. Mm-hmm. Like, you look at Vigilante Gamer's site and he'll show, you know, like, meeting someone in a bar or like the strange meet at the police station or something. And there'll be whole situations, hostage situations. It's great. You know, we've bumped into people in the street before and then, you know, they have to survive. They have to sing Justin Bieber songs. Like, you know, kind of, you can create your own game of it. So I can see where he's coming from here.
Well, I think, you know,
he doesn't think it's so innovative.
Well, I think, you know, would virtual reality work in a game like that? That's kind of the... I guess it probably would, though, in that kind of environment. But I think his argument is that he's kind of experimenting with it. His studio are doing some VR stuff, but they're not... A lot of companies seem to be, like, you know, banking their entire fortunes on virtual reality and putting everything into it, whereas he's saying he kind of sees it as maybe it's going to be a bit of a gimmick that'll last a couple of years and phase out again. Maybe it's not going to quite change the industry the way that people were. I think he says here his greatest concern is overcreating games that are going to be too big, because he thinks the average player time of a virtual reality game will be around 20 minutes. It'll be a casual game.
Okay, yeah. Because, you know, when you're playing DayZ, it will be 8 hours.
Yeah. Are you going to walk around your room with a virtual reality headset on for 8 hours? Probably not, are you, to be fair?
You sustain quite a lot of injuries.
But I think there's another aspect to it as well. I mean, I've got, you know, we mentioned Google Cardboard on the show. I play around with that. But again, I'll put it on for 10, 15 minutes. It's a bit of fun, but it's not quite up there with the specs of the Oculus Rift or, you know, the Samsung one, for example. But I think when you're wearing a virtual reality headset, you really are cutting yourself off from the entire world, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, especially if you've got the headphones. Yeah. And I've only used it a very small time, so you've got a lot more experience with VR.
But I think when I often game, I'll be sitting on the couch and, like, my missus will be at home and she may be doing sitting on the other couch, she'll be on her phone or she'll be, you know, making dinner. We'll be chatting while I'm gaming and stuff like that. But I think if you've got a partner or even a family, putting a virtual reality headset on, you're cutting yourself off from everything, aren't you? The entire environment around you, even, like, gaming at college and that kind of thing.
It's interesting as well, because I saw this whole new thing about this. I can't even remember what it's called. Someone may be able to say in the notes, but it's a virtual reality social network, which is very interesting because Facebook own virtual reality.
Yeah, the Oculus Fit, mate.
Yeah. And this was basically a small island, and these guys went with the virtual reality headset, put it on, and you're sat in an island, but all these other people in the world have headsets on.
Like Second Life.
Yeah, and you can just communicate with them. And it creates a whole new kind of dimension. And as soon as you see that, you can see why Facebook have bought.
Yeah, wow. You know. I did wonder why they bought that. That does make sense, though. But that means if your wife wants to tell you that dinner's ready, she just puts it on and comes on the island.
Dinner's ready. Oh, sorry, I'm with my other wives.
My virtual wife. Yeah. Leave us in peace. Yeah. So that was quite interesting, though. I mean, virtual reality... Some people kind of say it's a bit like, you know, 3D to the movie industry. Because, you know, virtual reality, as our audience, I'm sure, are aware, is not a new thing. It's been around for a long time. And there was actually a comment on, I did a video about the Atari Jaguar on YouTube, and I think it must have been a younger guy. He'd looked at it, and it was around the time of the first VR explosion, wasn't it? And they were meant to bring out a virtual reality headset for the Jag. And there was a fully working prototype, and I think there's one game, Missile Command it was, randomly, that has got the VR headset support in the game itself, you know, if you've got it for the Jag, but obviously there's only a couple of prototypes of the headset that exist. But this guy commented on my video, goes, what, virtual reality, 1994, impossible.
Impossible?
Yeah, like you didn't know it had been around before.
Yeah, that's it. It's kind of like, oh, this is a new thing. We thought it had its day, you know?
Yeah, like, dude. I thought, you know, when it got to like 95, I was, oh, VR, it's over.
VR was actually one of those things that, you know, it was like pyramid scheme or something, something you wouldn't invest in.
You know, even now, though, I think Google Cardboard and this McDonald's headset that we were talking about last week, that kind of makes it accessible. But stuff like the Oculus Rift and that, it's really for, you know, you've got to be an ultra hardcore enthusiast to fork out like maybe $4,000 you're talking for a full setup, aren't you, really?
Yeah, totally.
It puts it out the hands of casual gamers. You've got to really be enthusiastic about it. But I think the first time around VR, it was more the arcade environment, but arcades are not really around anymore. Mm. And the tech wasn't there.
But, yeah, also, you know, when they first did VR, it was multiplayer.
Yeah.
So you had four people playing it or two people playing
next
it.
Next to each
you're
other.
Both next to each other in the arena. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I've seen a lot of the VR, apart from this social stuff, has been just sitting there experiencing stuff on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right, yeah. Which, because the arcades aren't there anymore, that's probably the main reason in that, isn't it? It's got to be online now, but then again, you need your friend to also fork out $4,000 for a setup, don't you?
So. Now, I'm going to talk about something pretty rude at the moment, which is 3D pornography for VR headsets.
I've been seeing that everywhere.
Which is absolutely all over the internet, and lots of people have been using it. And one of the funny things is there's been lots of stories of people with VR headsets that are immersed in what they're doing, and then someone walking in the room not noticing, you know.
When you're wearing that headset, man, you're, that amazing. You're disconnected from the world, anything can happen. Mum knocks on your door, you don't hear her.
Yeah, that's it. So it's a complete a strange thing.
It is.
Going to these other worlds.
It's exciting, but I think, you know, it's the price has got to be down there for the average consumer to take it seriously, I think. But
yeah,
we'll see where it goes. Obviously, we'll keep an eye on VR.
Well, I used to be into this TV show called The Tribe, and they had this whole thing where they invented VR called Paradise, and it was so good. Their lives were just so crap that they'd just sit there in the VR headsets and completely like, space out.
Could be Red Dwarf, better than life, wasn't it?
Yeah, better than life, that's awesome. It. Or the holodeck on Star Trek.
I'll buy one when that comes along, All right, guys, thank you so much for checking out this week's episode of The Retro Hour. You can, of course, get it every Friday from our website, theretrohour.com. And now, this week's guest...
Yes, we're bringing you someone that no one else will bring. This is Galahad of Fairlight.
So this week on the Retro Hour, maybe a slightly controversial guest, as this guy was involved in some of the biggest cracking and piracy groups on the Amiga back in the day, groups like Fairlight and LSD. Welcome to the Retro Hour, Galahad, where we'll start at the beginning. What first sparked your interest in computers?
Well, I was quite young a long time ago, and how old was I? Five, and they got a BBC Model B. In fact, no, I think it was a BBC Model A back then. In the school for the first time, and I remember the first thing I ever typed on a computer was play Astro Wars, and it took me about 3 minutes to type it out. I'd never seen a keyboard before. Curiously enough, it didn't play Astro Wars. It basically told me to get stuffed. But even back then, I was impressed by the games it could do. There was Killer Gorilla, there was Felix and the Evil Weevils, and all sorts of early Beeb stuff. And I thought, yeah, this is quite good. And then I saw a Commodore 64 and thought, yeah, that's what I want. And my parents had different ideas. They were entranced by the idea of educational software. So I ended up with a BBC Micro, which was about the least well-supported computer in the entire country.
School computer, wasn't it?
Yeah, you ended up getting conversions of stuff, well, I don't know, about a year after everybody else, and it was always not quite as good. I think Elite was the only one that was considered the de facto version on the Beeb at the time. So yeah, it was seeing a computer running at school that got me into computers.
How did this kind of develop then? What stuff were you doing on the computers later on?
Well, actually, nothing. All I did was play games on the thing. I didn't try and do any kind of programming. I didn't do anything. All I was interested in doing was going to my mate's house, who had a twin tape deck, so with a fast mode on it, so we could copy the cassettes really fast, and then go home and see whether or not it actually worked, because you'd use some rubbish Chinese cassette tape, so you might have to pedal back over to his house and do another one on a better quality tape. But as far as computers went and the BBC went, playing games was it.
So that kind of tape-to-tape copying, was that kind of your first introduction into the piracy scene then?
Well, I wouldn't even call it a piracy scene. It was a mate of mine whose dad was a copper, and he didn't mind his son copying games for people. And you know, there was no protection or anything like that on the Beeb. I think they did protection for discs, but back then for cassettes and that, there was nothing apart from the the odd colour chart, what have you, with Manic Miner. He had this horrible piece of paper with a million colours on, but I was one of those people that duplicated it onto another piece of paper so that I could play it. I didn't have the skills back then to crack anything. That was beyond me. My abilities were playing games back then, and everything else was just alchemy and magic as far as I was concerned.
It was so rampant as well with the tape piracy. We'd all be doing it at home.
I think it's been the same with every single format. You know, once there's an easy way to copy it, I think software companies were just hoping to get a few good week sales out of it, and then it was straight on to the next game. Yeah, games really, that was it. I wasn't really interested in games wasn't interested in doing anything else until I saw an Amiga for the first time. And I pretty much ignored it till a friend of mine at school said, "Oh, I've got one of these new Commodore Amigas." I'm like, "What's that then?" So I got invited to go round, and holy moly, that was just, well, the BBC never got touched ever again after that, not even for the odd nostalgia trip. It was just like, holy shit, this guy's got an arcade machine in his bedroom. This is amazing. With a fateful diversion with an Atari ST very briefly, because I believe the salesman that the Atari ST was just like the Amiga. And when I got it home, I realised it was nothing like the Amiga, and it sounded awfully like a BBC as well.
We all make mistakes.
Oh, yes, we make mistakes. But thankfully, my dad was quite happy to take it back to the shop because he likes arguing with shop assistants. And I got my first Amiga with Kickstart 1.2, secondhand from some guy at Tesco's. I already had the games copied ready for it, got it home, set it all up. And, the rest is history, I suppose.
I never actually purchased a piece of original software for the Amiga. I think it was one, actually, Lemmings 2, and that was it.
I did buy quite a few games. I was a believer in, if I liked it enough, I would go and buy it. And I have got quite a collection of originals, but I would say that the amount of originals that I had versus how many copies I had, the balance might be more towards the crack copies more than the originals. More than anything, part of the reason was the cost of the damn things. You go from games for like $9.99, and then it just a massive leap up to like $25.99, which is what Amiga stuff used to be. It always used to be a fiver more than the Atari ST version, and spookily enough, you were getting the exact same version, and it wasn't much better.
Do you think Amiga games were too expensive around that time?
Oh, way too expensive. Especially when, with the exception of a few developers like the likes of Enterprise Software, the guys when the Amiga started who really, really put the effort in. A lot of the other software companies really didn't put the effort in to warrant charging an extra £15 over what people were used to paying. I mean, a Premier game on the Commodore 64, what was it? It was between $9.99 and $14.99, depending if you got the cassette or the disc. But the Amiga was like a massive jump. And all it was, nine times out of ten, it was a hastily cobbled together ST version with maybe a couple of bells or whistles if the person doing the conversion had the time. It was the ST version. And you're thinking, Jesus, my Amiga doesn't seem that powerful at all. It can barely do anything better than the Atari ST.
Well, Galahad, you know, obviously you said then you were a kid who played games mainly. How did that move on from you just playing games to becoming part of these massive cracking teams then?
I wasn't very good at doing music, although I changed that later on and actually had a piece of music featured in a game. I wasn't very good at graphics. I wasn't very good at demo programming. That was a level of maths that I just didn't possess. But I like messing around with stuff. And I suppose the first time I started showing an interest and a leaning towards the darker side of things was Amiga Disk Drives Inside and Out by Abacus, which was a book. And the other thing was an Action Replay Mark I, which was an absolute pile of crap. It really was rubbish. But it gave you a chance to, be nosy around games and see what was going on. And if you screwed it up, you just reset the computer and you carried on, and you could be back to where you were within a couple of minutes. And it was just more inquisitiveness than anything else. And I was actually a self-taught programmer on the Amiga. I didn't pick up a book that taught me Motorola 68000. I It was through action replay and doing experiments in memory, assembling the instructions and looking at the monitor to see what the results were, which is how I taught myself coding.
So you're known as a member of ScoopX, Fairlight, LSD, Jewel Crew, Jewel Shining Crew. I was wondering how the pirates actually contacted you or how you got in contact with them.
I used to mail trade with Parasite of LSD. I was in nothing groups before then. I was just doing my own stuff, doing basic cracks. But it also gave me a chance to kind of experiment and hone my craft, so to speak, without the pressures of actually being on the scene. And I was mail trading with Parasite of LSD. And then one day asked me, did I want to join? Yeah, all right then, I'll join LSD, which at the time seemed absolutely awesome, but later in life seems faintly ridiculous. Wrote a few articles for Grapevine, wrote a cracking tutorial for Carrier Command, which some kind soul resurrected on an English Amiga board. Man, I was not very cool at writing when I was younger. I'm quite embarrassed by it, to be honest. Yeah, and from LSD, where the hell do I go from LSD? I joined ScoopX for 2 weeks, and then I was mail trading with Red Devil of Jewel Crew. Jewel Crew started spreading the stuff around, and then there was a couple of other little minor releases. And then there was a small little release called Mortal Kombat, which got the attention of Fairlight, because Fairlight had actually released Mortal Kombat already. But unfortunately for Fairlight, their version wasn't 100% because part of the data was corrupted on one of the discs.
Was that Sonya, was it? Sonya Blade didn't work.
Yeah, Sonya Blade character didn't work. And Nomad was furious because, obviously, 1993 was the Amiga's final big year. And Fairlight were just an absolute releasing factory. I would say out of the top 20 releases over Christmas time, Fairlight released well over half and beat everybody on them. And obviously Mortal Kombat was a big game, was a massive game. It's irrelevant whether or not it was of any good in comparison to the SNES or the Genesis. It was a massive title on the Amiga, one which the Amiga wasn't even supposed to get if it wasn't for Probe. We got it. Nomad cracked it, and obviously they released it saying, you know, gutted, can't do the Sonya character. If anybody else gets hold of it, you know, let us know. And well, obviously we got it, and I did it 100%. And then I got a call from Red Devil, who was the guy in charge of Jewel Crew Shining in the UK, and he said, look, do you mind if we don't release Mortal Kombat, which seemed quite mental, seeing it was the game of the year to release. And I said, well, why is that then? And he explained that Nomad wanted it so he could complete his release. He put full credits to us in the intro. And I thought to myself, well, do you know what? That doesn't seem such a bad idea, because Jewel Crew Shining by then were already starting to move away from cracking on the Amiga. They didn't really want to be known for doing that kind of stuff. They were more interested in the demo stuff than they were the cracking side. And to be honest, a couple of releases that we did have were completely by accident that we managed to get hold of them. It was never by design that we were going to get them. It's just that Red Devil knew the original supplier personally, and he agreed to supply them to us, and for free, which was unheard of back then as well. So I thought to myself, well, if Jewel Crew Shining aren't really that keen on continuing with the cracking, I'm pretty sure Fairlight are. So I said, yeah, they can have it. So I sent uploaded the disc to a Fairlight bulletin board. Nomad took it, took the data that he needed to fix his, released the fix, credited me in Red Devil. 2 weeks later, I was invited to join Fairlight. So, yeah, I think I might make the right decision on that basis.
Nice. So, with these cracking groups, was there a kind of moral code, or, you know, would people not accept money for stuff, or would there be kind of a code of ethics?
No, absolutely, resolutely not. To be honest, some of the people on the scene, some people have got this romantic notion that the scene was all romanticized and people would help each other out, and they would go, oh, you can have this game, guys, go ahead, you crack it, you're the best. No, none of that stuff. People were quite happy to stab each other in the back if they got the opportunity. Unfortunately, Fairlight also did that to another group. They got their distribution account shut down, so they couldn't get originals from the distributor up in Birmingham anymore. That's kind of a matter of record. Some crackers, they were in groups for the money. Obviously, when you're advertising a PO box and a crack intro, you're not doing it because you want to have a pen pal from Finland or Birmingham. It's because you want lamers, i.e. those that have got no real way of getting hold of crack copies, to send you money and you send them games. And that's what pays for all the originals, and that's what pays for your top cracker in Germany to not go to work that day, so he'll crack the game for you so you can release it. Unfortunately, for some of the groups, it was all about the money.
I guess you had to have a lot of kind of inside industry contacts and, you know.
No, you'd be surprised, actually. Not a great deal. We did have an original supplier who used to be a member of Cortex and Inner City of Mayhem called Ads, and he did have a contact in Amiga magazine. He never ever divulged who it was, but he supplied a couple of games from a magazine reviewer. Mortal Kombat and F-17 Stealth Fighter, they came from a disc duplicator in Wales, I think it was. Some of the games, like I released BC Kid for Dual, it was just Dual Crew back then, that came from a computer show. They rather silly had the Amiga inside like a kitchen cupboard turned backwards with the disc left in there. And we just kind of crowded around the unit, and I slipped my hand in there and managed to get to the disc eject button and get the disc out. And less than a week later, it was released on the scene and that. So you'd be surprised. There wasn't a huge amount of inside contacts, but for obvious reasons, a lot of the software companies weren't stupid. They would, you know, if they had a review copy, it wasn't quite the finished game, but there was enough of a finished game where a magazine could fairly review it. They'd obviously leave markers on the disc and that, so they knew where the version had come from. So if someone was stupid enough to just willy-nilly spread copies to whoever wanted them, you know, he could soon be tracked down from the software company saying, why are you giving out the discs that we've given you for review? Obviously, some people have got a price. So
I guess that happens now with screeners and stuff like DVD.
Well, it's perfect when it comes to the Oscars and that, because you look on the list to see who's what film's been nominated, and you know for an absolute fact that there's going to be a DVD quality copy of that film on a torrent site within the week before it's even come out in the cinemas in this country, in the UK. So, you know, software companies and the entertainment industry and film industry, they complain about piracy, but then they make it so easy, and you think, really, just how badly are they effective when they can score so many own goals? It doesn't ring true sometimes, I feel. So, that's not to say that piracy has no effect. Obviously, sometimes it can be too effective, but I'm a great believer. If you've got a really good game and it's a strong title, people will go out and buy it. So,
did you kind of view it as that then, that you were giving kids like a chance to try the games out, and did you always encourage them to buy them?
No, I could claim it's... I am a great believer. If you like a game, try and support a developer if you can and go and buy the game. But I'm not going to cling on to the notion that, yeah, do you know what? I did all this because I'm Robin Hood, but a little bit fatter and a little bit taller. It's the actual thrill of the whole thing. It's the getting the phone call at 9 o'clock in the morning from the original supplier. This game's going to be released today and this game's going to be released today. Are you able to do them? And then you say yes, and then you ring up work and give them some bullshit excuse as to why it is you won't be going into work today. You can't explain it's because you're going to be cracking Empire Soccer, because that's not going to work. So, oh dear, I'm ill again. And then you're waiting for the phone call from the original supplier to say that he's got it, and then you then try and identify what protection's on the disc, and then you're telling the original supplier how to get it to you, and whilst you're doing this, there's somebody in another group that's probably in the exact same situation. And it's a race against time. And it's not just about the cracking. I mean, some of these games, the protection on them was an absolute joke. You literally were done in a couple of minutes. But it's the thrill of the entire process. It's the race. It's packaging the game. It's getting the cracker on there. It's getting it back to the original supplier, who then contacts the traders to get them all onto the world headquarters. And it's letting the SISOP of the world headquarters know that we've got a release. So he goes and kicks off everybody that isn't a Fairlight member. So all the Fairlight members can be sat there waiting for the release to come. And then it's uploading it to that board. And then it's then hitting all the world headquarters of all the rivals and all the headquarters of your own boards and that, in the hope that you can beat everybody on the release.
Were you scared doing it at all? Because of the authorities around at the time, and you know.
The only time I got a little bit concerned about it is we use calling cards, AT&T calling cards. I didn't ask where they came from. I didn't ask who they originally belonged to, but obviously we were blue boxing and using AT&T calling cards to call America. And potentially if I'd have been caught using them, then I could have been prosecuted for fraud, which would have been, you know, quite serious. I mean, my father didn't really have a great deal of interest in what I was doing, as long as I didn't get caught, and it meant that he didn't have to pay for the game, so he was all for it. But I don't think even my father realised just how much I was doing and what I was doing, and didn't feel any desire to inform him, because I'd imagine my stay on the Amiga scene would have been very short-lived. So, yeah, I mean, from the calling card I'm always never worried about the blue boxing, because British Telecom really didn't give us stuff because it wasn't costing them any money. But the AT&T calling cards, a few guys got busted for that big time, and a couple of them had done jail time for it as well. So, you know, it was a concern, but when you get into this kind of thing, and, you know, there's a release to spread, you'll take all sorts of stupid chances because it's all part of the thrill, I suppose.
I remember reading Grapevine, and around one time, particularly when Fast came on the scene, it seemed there was like, you know, two or three busts every issue. I mean, did you ever get busted or know anyone that did?
Nomad got busted, but they didn't know who they had, and he managed to blag his way out of it. Methanoid, he went under a different name. He was one of the main SISOPs for Cortex. He got caught and he didn't get all of his equipment back until it was completely obsolete by then.
They used to take everything.
Oh, yeah. They would take anything that looked computer-related. If you had a computer control toaster, that was it. That was going as well. They were, they were really thorough, but they didn't have a clue what they were doing. You know, I doubt they had anybody in the police that knew how to use an Amiga. They probably had to ask their sons, right, so how the hell do we read a disc on an Amiga? What command do we have to put in? We've used all the PC ones and nothing works. I would imagine that they just held on to them. They didn't know what the hell they were doing. So, I mean, I didn't know any personally, locally to me, that got done, but you didn't really care, to be honest. If someone else got caught, that's just because they weren't careful enough. I mean, I only ever used calling cards when I absolutely had to. Other than that, it was blue boxing. And police weren't really that fussed about it, to be honest.
I guess you must have left Fairlight before Operation Buccaneer and Fastlink.
Yeah, well, obviously, I'd spent that much effort on the Amiga that I didn't really get into anything else. I mean, I was invited by Icarus of Lightforce to get into doing some console cracking, but I'd been doing it for quite a few years, and It's a thrill at first, but when you're meeting the same copy protections time and time again, or someone's made no effort to implement their protection properly, eventually the thrill starts to go a little bit, because it is always nice to have a little bit of a challenge. And then the process gets, when you get so successful where you're constantly beating other groups, it gets a little bit boring. And I really didn't fancy doing that all again on another format, because the Amiga was such a fantastic machine for its time. I mean, it was light years out of the PC. My attitude towards the PC is still tainted by that experience, where I absolutely loathe PCs. I loathe laptops. I use them out of necessity, not because I want to.
Well, kind of going on from that, I mean, one thing you often read in the magazines around then, and still people say it today, what's your opinion on the argument that software piracy was one of the main reasons for killing the Amiga?
Rubbish, at the end of the day. Piracy does have an effect in some ways, but I'm a great believer that if you've got a good game, it will sell. It's as simple as that. If you've got a well-marketed game, it will sell. I mean, you only have to look at some of the software companies that were still hanging around the Amiga in 94 and 95. Even Psygnosis was still releasing stuff in 94/95. There was lots of contributing factors, but the main one, without a shadow of a doubt, was the Sony PlayStation. It didn't just do the Amiga. It did the Amiga, it did the Mega Drive, it did the Super Nintendo. That was the major factor. I mean, what people seem to forget is by then the Amiga was getting on for 10 years old. And much as I love the Amiga and think it was a fantastic machine for its time, technology was moving on and was getting better and was doing stuff that the Amiga couldn't do. There's only so many times that you're going to play a platformer game before you start jealously looking over the shoulder of someone who's playing a full vector 3D game. And things kind of moved on and the Amiga didn't. And that's where you blame Commodore, because much as I think the A1200 and the A4000 are decent machines, they are absolutely not what the Amiga needed. The Amiga needed something of a level, the fantastic feeling that people felt when they saw the Amiga 500 for the first time and what it did. I mean, most of the music on the Amiga is fantastic, but why was it still an 8-bit sound chip? Why wasn't it 16-bit? Why wasn't it at least, 30 channels? Why was it only 2 mega chip RAM? Why was the Blitter the same speed when it had more data to throw around? Why was it only 14 megahertz 0.20 and the economy version to boot as well? Why didn't the A1200 have a hard drive as standard? I mean, that was part of the reason why the likes of Sierra and LucasArts abandoned the Amiga, was because their games were getting ridiculously big. And one of their games, was it 12 discs?
Yeah, Monkey Island 2, was it, yeah?
Yeah, 12, yeah. 12 discs.
I think it was,
and
yeah.
And their modern stuff was 256 colour graphics. So even if they'd done the best graphics possible on the Amiga, their latest games would have been like 40, 50 discs worth. And you just can't distribute something like that. And I think the writing was on the wall when you had, I think it was Amiga Format, or it might have been Future Publishing. They could kind of see the writing was on the wall, and they kind of called a conference together because they were worried that, I think to quote them, they said something like, the Amiga was next on the self-imposed hit list. And Commodore UK were on board. All the major developers like Sensible, the Bitmap Brothers and what have you were all on board, telling Commodore what they wanted the next Amiga to have. I mean, you had the enviable thing where you had developers clamoring to want to stay and do stuff with the Amiga, and they said, like, do this, do this, do this, do this, and do this, and you've got a killer machine, and we will write software for it. And basically, all we got was a 1200, which was a slightly faster processor, quite a few more colors, but outdated hardware, throwing it all around. Commodore didn't have a clue what they had, but their customer base did. But Commodore never really listened to anybody.
Galahad, 20 years almost after your final days in Fairlight, you're actually still involved in the Amiga scene now then. So tell us a bit about Putty Squad, for example, and the CD32 project that you're working on these days.
Well, Putty Squad was actually started off as, I'm going to contact Mark Cale. It is actually started because obviously everyone knew that Putty Squad had been done, and there was lots of promises made to release it. And I'd had enough of all this. So I was penning a snotogram to send to him. And basically what I was doing was I was kind of thinking ahead of any excuse that he was going to come out with and shooting them all down. If it's because it's stuck on Amiga, I can get it off. If it's because they're stuck on copy-protected discs, yeah, I'm pretty sure I can get it off there as well. If it's stuck on a PC, if it needs assembly, if it needs disc, any excuse I could think that he could think of, I could, counteract, where the only option left to him would either be to come clean and say, all right, we haven't got any more, we lost it years ago, it's gone, or come on then, come and sort it out.
Because on the forums for about 10 years, people were like, does it exist, doesn't it?
You were really doubting it.
I never thought we'd see it.
Yeah. Well, I am the bringer of dreams. it started off as a really nasty snotogram. And then I thought, actually, if it turns out that they have still got it, he's probably not going to appreciate me with this tone. So I then deleted it and restarted it again and acted all nicey-nicey and happy and jolly and quite happy to help you out and all this kind of stuff, expecting him to come out with some nonsense excuse so I could go back on English Amiga board and say, look, I've shot this guy's excuses down as to why he can't release it. And yeah, he hasn't got it anymore. He's basically talking out his arse. He's a liar. But obviously the opposite is true. He went, when do you want to come down and do it? And I'm like, oh, so perhaps it does exist then. And then he put me in contact with John Twitty, and we spoke over the phone for quite a bit. And then he explained where it was, and it was all originally I was supposed to be going down to the System 3 offices to go and go down there and copy it all, and or maybe sit on their PC and do it. And he said, "Oh, well, everything's on the PC up here." I went, "Oh, well, that makes life a lot easier. You can just email it to me, can't you?" Yeah, I'll do that then. So he emailed me a zip file with everything in it. And sure enough, the entire game was there. And I explained to him how his disk system would be a problem. And curiously, he never asked how I was so intimately aware of how his copy-protected disk system worked and why certain things would need to be removed and done in a certain way. But he just ignored that, frankly. And yeah, I had an email contact with him over a couple of days. And then I said to him, yeah, I can do it. It's not a problem. And obviously they were like, right, well, crack on. So off I went and started doing it, and then sent him a version and then versed him in the intricacies of WinUAE and where to find a Kickstarter. In fact, I think I sent him a Kickstarter ROM instead of him downloading it from a dodgy source. Explained to him how to use it and how to boot up the test version I'd done for him so he could see that he hadn't just handed it over to an idiot. You know, I could actually do what I said I could do. And they were well happy. And then we decided, right, Christmas Eve, it's when it's going to be released. Can you do it for then? I was like, yeah, it's not a problem. It's easy. So I took a couple of days off just to take the piss a little bit. And then carried on another couple of days later, watching the fallout on the internet as people were offering their opinions of what a bunch of Git System 3 were. And there's me having a little nod and a chuckle to myself, really itching to say something. And I thought I'd add a few bits of comments saying, if this bloody game exists, I'll eat my hat, et cetera, et cetera. Stoking the fires just a little bit more. Yeah, obviously I sent it off to System 3 on the 21st of December so they could play test it, and they were very happy. And then I realized I hadn't put a crack intro on it. And I went, oh, I've just found a bug. Hang on whilst I do another master version for you. And I actually put a Fairlight intro in there. And then just before I was about to send it, I thought, I haven't got the balls to do this because I think they might kick off if there's a Fairlight intro.
It was classic you all
Fairlight
along.
Intro with the Angel Dawn logo. And I don't think it's so much that they would know who I was. I think it was more the fact that it would be Fairlight. And I don't care what part of the software industry you're in. In the last 20 years, every software developer's heard of Fairlight, whether they like it or not. Some people might nod sagely and go, yeah, bastards. And other people might get proper pissy about it. And I didn't want the release to be jeopardized. So I thought, no, I can't do this. So I quickly cobbled together an intro just saying Galahad with lots of stupid pink squares, which I am quite manly normally, but for some reason I like the kind of scheme. Hid that in there, sent it back to them. They play tested it. They went, thanks very much. That's bloody awesome. And I originally offered to do it for free. I refused to take... I was removing reasons why they wouldn't get me to do it, because obviously I knew I could do it and I didn't want them handing it to some idiot that couldn't do it. And then the next thing you know, all the source code and files have been leaked onto the internet because Billy Nobody couldn't do it. So he's leaked it in the hope that somebody else can do it. And that's when they said, how would you like a PlayStation 4? I'm like, yeah, okay then. Which is a bit of a pisser because I just bought a load of games to the PS3 for the boy. And I didn't want a PS4 just yet because I knew as soon as I got one, I'm going to have to replace all the stuff on the PS3 that he likes for the PS4 version. So
System 3 have cost you a fortune.
Yeah, they have cost me a fortune. I mean, they give away these PS4s knowing damn well you've got to buy the pissing games for it. But yeah,
you and could I always got a, crack them.
Yeah. And I got a free copy of Putty Scored for the PS4, which the less said about that, the better. It's bloody awful.
Stick
it's
to the Amiga horrible, one.
Just horrible rendered graphics where everything clashes, and they've remixed the tunes, and the Amiga ones sound infinitely better. And no, it's like 900 megabytes of ugh. Yeah. So, and obviously it got released on Christmas Eve. And basically, 6 o'clock, Christmas Eve, everything went live, bang, all at the same time. And it was, it goes back to that cracking thrill. It was great to just sit there and see the reactions on all the forums and that. And it's a good feeling. It's a bit like cracking all over again, where you've done something, where you know people appreciate it and that. You don't have to say anything to anyone. You can just sit in the background and everyone's going, oh, bloody brilliant. I don't care how big and tough you are. It makes you feel good when people appreciate the stuff that you do. So, it was a good feeling. I think I appreciated the outpouring of, I don't want to say the word love because that sounds a little bit wishy-washy, but the outpouring of, yeah, nice one.
Appreciation.
Was better for me than actually having System 3 saying, yeah, can you do it then? And I still get the odd email every now and again saying, oh, thanks for Putty Squad. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's all right, but it's not that good.
Well, Galahad, it's been fascinating talking to you tonight. We've actually reached the end of our show this week, but it's been amazing getting an insight into your past with the Amiga cracking scene, and also it's great to have you still involved in the Amiga as well. Are you working on anything at the moment that people should look out for?
There's a possibility I might be doing something for a classic Amiga game, but I can't say anything at the moment. I'm still waiting to see whether or not my offer's been accepted. I'd like to say something, but I don't want to jinx it in case they say, no, we've got it all covered, thanks very much. I'm hoping they're going to turn around and say yes, because I can do a better job they can. And without being big-headed, I know I can do a better job they can. And it would actually shave off weeks and weeks off their release. So if it happens, great. If it don't, you won't be getting as good a version as could have been. I'm doing some more Atari ST conversions. Starquake should be ready in the next 3 weeks, and then Ranorama after that, and then I might get into looking at Sundog Frozen Legacy, because lots of people have been going on about that one. So yeah, it's picking through the best of the ST stuff before everybody else jumps on the bandwagon and starts doing the same thing.
Well, it's been great to hear from you.
Thank you, gents.
Thank you so much, mate.